This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Anthony Brooks is off today. This week, new polls put Senator Scott Brown and the leading Democratic challenger Elizabeth Warren within single digits of each other in the race for the Massachusetts Senate seat. At the same time, Senator Brown dives headfirst into the debate over contraception.
This is about the ability for religious groups, churches, universities who want to practice their faith in adherence to our Constitution and the rights that we've had for over 200 years.
Meanwhile, a Kennedy returns to Brookline.
Hi, I'm Joe Kennedy, and I'm announcing a campaign to be your Democratic nominee for the 4th Congressional District seat now held by Barney Frank.
Plus, NSTAR and Northeast Utilities reach an agreement that puts a little breeze into the fan blades for Cape Wind.
This was a very important milestone, and it really catalyzes the project and moves it forward.
Well, that's just some of the week's news, and joining us now to go over it is Renee Loth, columnist for the Boston Globe. Great to see you again, Renee.
Happy to be here.
Also with us this week is Bruce Mole. He's editor of Commonwealth Magazine. Great to have you as well, Bruce.
Good to be here.
Well, let's start straight off with the new polling numbers. One set of polls coming from WBUR that put Senator Scott Brown and his leading Democratic challenger, Elizabeth Warren, within single digits of each other. The BUR poll found that they're about 3 points apart, plus or minus the margin of error. And last night, a Suffolk University poll had Scott Brown leading by 9 points. So first thought on what seems to be, at least a somewhat narrow race if they were to go head-to-head now. Renee.
Well, you know, first of all, I have kind of a love-hate relationship with polls. like most political junkies, I'm addicted to them, but I've also been burned by them badly. And Bruce actually remembers, probably, when we were colleagues at the State House during the gubernatorial campaign in 1990, the Boston Globe had this big poll the weekend before the primary for the governor's race that had Frank Bellotti 11 points up over John Silber, mm-hmm. 2 days before the primary. Okay, so yeah, polls, love them, hate them, you know, they really, I'm trying not to be paying too much attention to the polls, and I urge your readers and listeners also not to. Having said that,
I was going to say, be that as it may.
Having said that, I do think that the math benefits Warren. I was looking at the voter tallies from the special election, and Scott Brown won a little bit over 1 million votes, 1.1 million votes. And that's the same amount that John McCain won in the presidential election in 2008, much bigger turnout. So the point is, that's like all the Republican votes there are in mm-hmm. Massachusetts. And Scott Brown already has gotten all of those. But there is a lot of people that he needs to get to vote for him who've never voted before in a big presidential campaign where the turnout will be much higher and the energy will be on the side of the Democrats in this state.
Well, Bruce, let me ask you about that, because the other sort of big takeaway number that I found from the WBUR poll is that 60% of those polled said they still might change their minds.
Yeah, I think this is going to be a pretty close race right through the end because both are going to have more than enough money to get their message out there unfiltered to voters. And I think Brown has a bit of an advantage in one sense. Everybody else is a Democrat in Massachusetts, and he can say, I'm at least playing with the powers that be down in Washington. And until recently, I thought he was walking that tightrope pretty well. Mm. He stumbled a little bit this past week, but I think he's going to be very competitive, and he's got plenty of money, and I think ideologically Warren's going to have a tough road to go.
Okay, yeah. So we'll talk about what you called a stumble in just a second.
Yeah.
But polling is one set of numbers. Another set of numbers is money, and which are maybe possibly more revealing at this point in time in the race. And the Boston Globe took a look at fundraising numbers for Senator Brown and Elizabeth Warren and found that Elizabeth Warren thus far has raised the majority of her money from outside the Commonwealth, largely from donors in California and New York. But this time around for Senator Brown, it was the opposite. Two-thirds of his current campaign funding has come from within the state. What do you make of that?
Well, you know, in the special election, most of Scott Brown money came from outside of the state.
Right.
So, I think the challenger, in a way, attracts his, Elizabeth Warren is sort of the new fresh face. She's the hope of the Democratic Party here. I think she attracts a lot of national attention. There's no question that this race is going to be one of the key top, national races that everybody's going to be paying attention to. I think you'll probably see plenty of out-of-state money for Scott Brown, too.
As we get closer to the actual election. Bruce, do you agree?
Yeah, because The last time he ran, when it became apparent that he might have a chance of winning, the money poured in from all over the country.
There was a bit of a tsunami in the last right. 2 weeks, right?
And I think it'll work for both candidates this time. If it's a close race, everybody, it'll become a national race, and the money will pour in from all over the place.
I'm still curious to see, and we can't know this yet, but I mean, this is the first major Senate race we've had in Massachusetts after the Citizens United ruling in the Supreme Court. We've seen the effect the super PACs have had on the presidential primaries, so let's see if that might have any effect in the long run here in Massachusetts. But Bruce, let's come back to your point about Senator Brown's recent actions this week. And he and Elizabeth Warren really sparred over the question of religious freedom and contraception and whether or not health insurance companies and religious employers who offer health insurance should be required to give insurance that covers contraception. So, Senator Brown has co-sponsored a bill that establishes a conscience exemption that would basically allow all health plans to refuse to cover anything that counters their beliefs. And Elizabeth Warren says, nope, that's outright discrimination. So here's a little tape from Senator Brown shooting back at that in an interview with NECN's Jim Browdy.
But the fact that Professor Warren wants to drive a wedge between women and their faith and take really this assault on the Catholic Church and, more importantly, distort my record on this issue, it's sad, but that's what you get to expect.
Renee, on the one hand, this is absolutely a national issue right now vis-a-vis the Obama administration's recent sort of ruling and unruling about this. But what do you make of the fact that Senator Brown has waded into the fray?
Well, you know, Senator Brown just mentioned in that clip his record. And, you know, it was less than a year ago that he joined Senator Kerry in opposing cuts to Planned Parenthood. And he wrote a letter at the time, it was a vote, and he wrote a letter at the time saying, you know, quote, I support family planning and health care for women. And, you know, and he's pointed to this vote and to this letter and his position as being evidence of his, you know, supposed independent stance and that he's, you know, not ideological. And yet in that clip, you heard nothing but Republican talking points. I mean, it's just you could almost mouth the words he was about to say before he said it, you know, an assault on religious freedom and a wedge between women and their faiths. This is what the national Republicans have been saying on this issue, and it really is confounding to me that Senator Brown would jump on this.
Bruce, is it really so contradictory to have, as Renee pointed out, written a letter in support of Planned Parenthood, but also co-sponsor a bill that, according to Senator Brown, protects religious freedoms?
I don't think it's inconsistent necessarily, but I think the issue gets sort of complicated quickly, and I think most people hear, oh, he's taking issue with contraception. You go, what? What is he doing? And given that he needs women voters, especially in this state, I think it's a crazy venture for him. He didn't have to sign on. He could have just remained silent.
Well, I wonder, some people have said this is sort of election year legislating that Senator Brown's doing. You could say the same thing about President Obama and his initial policy change that he asked for that got the Catholic Church worked up. I mean, do you believe that there's politics really driving here? Renee seems to think so.
Well, I guess it's hard for me to figure out what his politics are. It's been speculated that maybe he's trying to bring in money from around the country, but I don't think that's going to be a problem for him, frankly. So I don't really see. I just think it's a wrong move. I just don't understand it politically.
Yeah, I don't understand it politically either. I mean,
politically for Massachusetts in particular.
Yes, and for Brown. I mean, I'm not talking about Obama or the national parties here now. I just think that, you know, if he's trying to now appeal to a very conservative religious strain in the country or even in the state, he has no credibility on that because of his position on Planned Parenthood less than a year ago. You know, these people, as we saw with the bishops, don't compromise. It's not like enough to be, you know, for a conscience exemption, but then before Planned Parenthood. I mean, they see those two things as in opposition. And, you know, even though it may not appear inconsistent to us, I think they would see it as being totally on, you know, sort of a Mitt Romney problem, you know, being on both sides of this issue. So I don't see where he gets any credit on either end. You know, he seems to be waffling on this.
And yet he's very scripted in that interview.
Yes.
He refers to Elizabeth Warren as the professor several times,
yeah,
and as, you know, very, very like Martha Coakley, another code word of, you know, loser or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
And so he's obviously following a script here that he thinks is worthwhile pursuing. And it maybe he really believes it. I don't know. But politically, I thought it was damaging.
Hmm. You know, the one thing that I thought was really interesting of that poll that I've just dissed were some of the internal questions that were asked about where respondents were asked for one word kind of Rorschach test responses to the two candidates. And that was really interesting to me because it indicated to me that a lot of what Brown has been saying about Warren, trying to paint her as an elitist and a professor and all of this, is taking. And that people see, when they ask what you think about her, they'll say intelligent or they'll say elitist or they'll say professor. You know, that starts to catch on.
But on the other hand, she is a professor.
Yeah.
That is her proper title. So I can't necessarily blame Senator Brown for using that. We would refer to him as senator, which is his title as well. But let's drill down a little bit into congressional politics at the district level, because in what Boston Globe's Glenn Johnson has called on our air perhaps the least surprising announcement in recent Massachusetts political history, Joe Kennedy III has, yes, officially declared he's running for Congress. And for the two people out there who wondered if he's that kind of Kennedy, yes, he is.
My family has had the great privilege of serving Massachusetts before. They taught me that public service is an honor, given in trust, and that trust must be earned each and every day. That's exactly what I intend to do.
Bruce, that's from Joe Kennedy III's internet video announcement. So what do you make of the fact that another Kennedy's on the ballot here in Massachusetts?
Well, I watched it, and I thought he looked incredibly young.
Everything's relative, Bruce.
He's in his early 30s.
But he's handsome. He's got everything, you know, going his way here. The one area that I think he's going to have a hard time is no one really knows much about him, and this district has been reconfigured a bit. So he's going to have to not only get up to speed with them quickly, but convince some areas that are fairly conservative that he's the right way to go.
And he's running in the 4th Congressional District, which, of course, for 16 terms was served by Barney Frank. Mm-hmm. And in the recent redistricting that the state's gone through, Bruce, as you were mentioning, it's lost some towns and absorbed some others that are a little more conservative, maybe, than Newton, which is sort of the population heart of the district. Renee, your thoughts?
That's right. Well, first of all, you know, let's not pretend that Joe Kennedy is the first politician to trade on a legacy name. Okay, you know, we just in the last couple of years, we had George Bush, we had, you know, Hillary Clinton, even Nikki Tsongas, you know, do benefit from their associations, from their names. And they cut both ways. I mean, there are some negatives to being a Kennedy as well, and we'll find out what those are. So, you know, but all politics is relative, and Kennedy is not Barney Frank. And so even though it looks like we may have the same Republican challenger, Sean Bilat, the race against Kennedy will not be the same as the race against Barney Frank. Right?
Well,
because Kennedy is a new face. He's not part of the problem, you know, that kind of thing. Whereas the attack on Barney was very, very different.
He had a 16-term record,
right,
essentially, that Bilat really focused
That's
in
right.
on. Well, there's a lot more to talk about regarding Kennedy as time goes on. And as you mentioned, Bruce, since he's not maybe terribly well-known, we'll get to know him over time. And Sean Bilat, Renee, as you mentioned, is running on the Republican side, along with several other candidates, which we'll continue to cover here on Radio Boston. But before we run out of too much time, I did want to just talk briefly about the NSTAR Northeast Utility Agreement. It was a merger agreement between NSTAR and Northeast Utilities, where they reached a deal with the state of Massachusetts that would basically freeze rates, give some money back to Massachusetts customers, and commits NSTAR to buying a large chunk of the Cape Wind energy produced by the Cape Wind projects. That's, of course, those wind turbines that are going to be perhaps built off Nantucket Sound. So, Bruce, your first thoughts about this merger?
Well, the merger has been hanging around for more than a year now, and I guess after it was announced, the Patrick administration and the Attorney General separately started to negotiate a settlement with them. The Patrick administration has played really hardball on this one. They weren't going to give up. They wanted to get approval for NSTAR to buy a big chunk of Cape Wind, which NSTAR didn't want to do. But eventually they had to cave because they wanted this merger to go through, and they needed Patrick's approval for it.
And now they're going to buy about a quarter of the power that Cape Wind's supposed to generate.
Yeah, at the price that National Grid, the other major utility, bought 50% of Cape Wind's output, and they paid 18 cents a kilowatt hour, which is very high relative today. It's usually about 6 to 8 cents. And this deal calls for NSTAR to pay roughly the same rate, even though the price of electricity is going down generally. Hmm. So it's a very gutsy move by Patrick to get this project off the ground, but it's also controversial because he's basically saying you've got to go with this company.
Renee, do you have any thoughts about whether or not it's good for customers?
Well, you know, I mean, it sort of depends on where you stand on alternative energy. I mean, it needs government to step in and give it a boost, either through deals like this or through direct, subsidies or research grants, that kind of thing, because it's not going to happen with the market alone. And, you know, if you do believe that we need to be moving down that road in an aggressive way, then this is an important step in that direction.
Hmm. Well, finally, usually we wrap up our Week in Review with our Hubbub segment, but we've decided to actually put that aside this week because of the news that we all heard last night about the passing of Anthony Shadid, who was, in my mind and in many others, one of the great foreign correspondents of our time. He was working for the New York Times, and he passed away crossing over the Syrian border. An amazing career, just 43 years old, worked for the Washington Post, worked for the Boston Globe. Renee, your thoughts on Anthony Shadid?
Yeah, I didn't know him that well at the Globe. He was overseas most of the time, but I do remember when he was shot in Ramallah, and our editor, Marty Baron, flew over there to get him back here and get some good health care for him and to negotiate his flights back and everything. It's just terribly sad. I mean, he so represented the classic foreign correspondent who believed in the mission of bringing the news out of conflict areas for the public and of bearing witness to the lives of real people in those places. We do a lot of opining about, foreign policy, but until you're there on the ground with these people, I think you can't really understand the impacts of policy decisions. And Shadid was really interested in bringing that forward.
I think that's for me. I mean, I have never been a foreign correspondent, but I've spoken with Shadid a number of times. For me, that's the greatest loss, that we as Americans who used to read his articles really now, with his passing, don't have, through his voice and his connection with the people upon whom policy is actually enacted, to get a sense as to what life is like in the region that he covered in the Middle East. I mean, Bruce, do you have any thoughts?
Well, I went back and listened to his interview with Terry Gross a while ago, and it really hit home about the dangers that he faced. And there was this one episode in Libya where he and a group of people were trapped and took off running and then got really trapped. And he thought they were about to be killed because someone said, kill them. And then they suddenly just changed their mind. They said they're Americans. And you could, as you followed what he said, you could see his life pass in front of his eyes practically. And it shows you the risks and the danger that he faced in doing the job that he did.
And also, you know what, through reading, I have to say, just as a member of the media, through reading his reportage, it made me proud that, that kind of journalism is being done. Renee Loth, columnist for the Boston Globe, and Bruce Moll, editor for Commonwealth Magazine, thank you both for joining us today. And Bruce, you mentioned that you had heard that interview that Anthony Shadid had done with Terry Gross on Fresh Air. We actually have a little tape from that because we wanted to hear from Anthony himself. And as you reminded us, in 2011, he was one of several journalists who were kidnapped and beaten while covering the Libyan uprising. And one thing that he did tell Terry was that didn't really change what he thought of the mission of journalism should be.
I think I had questions of whether I should put myself in these places again. And I think I had to think about what the worth of what I do as a journalist. And again, that's where I come, and what I said earlier, that I think it is important what we do. And, maybe I'm just justifying it to myself. I don't know. Maybe I'll have a clearer sense of it 10 years from now. But I do come back to that point that I think what we do is worthwhile. What we do is important. And there's so fewer people who do it these days than when I started 15 years ago as a foreign correspondent, that I think it takes on even more importance, especially given the events that are happening around us.
That's Anthony Shadid, who's passed away. He was a legendary foreign correspondent for the New York Times, the Boston Globe, and the Washington Post. He was just 43. Again, Renee Loth and Bruce Moll, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.